Welcome to Shattering Myths. This program is devoted to the most important and to the fastest growing segment of our society. To those of you who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, isn't to repopulate these institutions with different people. It is instead to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, to try to hold them accountable, to understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It is caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because it's liberating, it's enriching, it's empowering covenant. It's one and only covenant. Provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion at any time over the next 3 hours, is toll-free. It's 877-300-7645. I'd like to begin where we ended up our program on Friday in Syria. A CNN article reads that organizationally, the opposition is a mess. Now, this is something that we have talked about at great lengths on this program. It's not that the opposition is a mess. It is that the opposition is every bit as corrupt, if not more corrupt, more counterproductive than is the regime. This article from CNN says several of the largest groups, including the Syrian National Council, aren't even showing up at the talks. You know, the fact is that the Syrian National Council is not one of the largest groups. The largest two groups of Mujahideen fighting in rebellion against the Shiite government are the Nusra Front, which is the Victory Front, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They are by far the two largest. There are another half a dozen, maybe even dozen, fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups that are engaged in the battle. Collectively, they all met about 2 months ago and decided that they would not be represented by the Syrian National Council and that they would only associate around one goal, which is to destroy Shia Islam and to establish a united Sunni Islam presence, not only in Syria, but also in Iraq and in Lebanon. That is their goal. That's the only thing that they would rally around, was their this notion of a Islamic government and the imposition of Sharia law. And so any time anyone in the West tries to say that there is a negotiation, that there are parties being represented at a negotiation, they are either ignorant or they are deliberately deceiving their audience. There is no such thing as the Syrian National Council. There is no such thing as the Free Syrian Army. It's a collection of Sunni Islamic terrorist organizations and guerrilla militant organizations acting as independent militias, fighting the Assad government for a religious purpose. Now, this article says, and it's true, rival rebel factions, the two largest, as a matter of fact, they don't name them, but it's the two largest, are massacring each other by the hundreds in the streets and alleys across Syria. Now, that was true, certainly, a week or so ago. It's very difficult to know what is happening inside of Syria, so we don't know if that is continuing. This would be Sunni killing Sunni. The article reads, even worse, none of the politicians who make up the majority of the Western-backed Syrian opposition are in the country, so they aren't in control of the military forces battling Assad's troops on the ground. That is correct. Not only aren't they in the country, they don't represent anyone in the country. The Western backing is for mythical groups. The Western backing is for sham organizations. And the reason for that is both sides in the Syrian conflict are repulsive. Both are vicious. Both are reprehensible. Both are unworthy of arming. the world would be better off if it just turned a blind eye to this and stopped providing weapons to both sides. In fact, the world would actually be better off, even though the Syrian regime is ruthless, having perhaps killed thousands of its own citizens, torturing them. That can't say their own citizens, because many of the Mujahideen have come from other countries and they have been armed by other countries. So they have disavowed citizenship. So they're really not Syrians that were tortured by the Syrian government. Would be an inappropriate conclusion. But nonetheless, this is a regime that perpetrates torture. The rebels are worse. You know, they are wont to rape innocent women. They are wont to enslave children and make them part of their militias. They are wont to kill fathers in front of their children. This is a despicable rebellion. And that no matter what is discussed amongst the Western-backed Syrian opposition, because they aren't in the country, they have no influence on what is occurring in the country. They have absolutely no influence whatsoever over the militias that are battling Assad's troops. And it even says here in this article, the military forces. There are no military forces battling Assad's troop. They're militias. They're jihadi organizations. I mean, to call a jihadist organization like the Nusra Front or the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria a military force is to suggest that the citizens of Iraq, both Sunni and Shia, that fought and killed Americans were a military force. It just aren't. I mean, it shows a complete disconnect as to what's actually happening in the Islamic world. The U.S. State Department said they hope a few rebel army leaders show up for the talks. But again, who are they and what weight will they actually carry? Well, we know who they are. It's just that we don't want to say who they are, because when they define themselves, they define themselves in purely fundamentalist Islamic jihadi terms. The principal rebel commander the U.S. was backing, the Free Syrian Army General, Salim Idris, fled the country in December. Yeah, because he doesn't have any authority. So here's this mythical creation of the West called the Free Syrian Army, and its leader isn't even in the country anymore. He had to flee. Why did he have to flee? Because there is no such thing as a Free Syrian Army. The influence of the group is being increasingly diminished by Islamist and Al-Qaeda-backed militants who the U.S. does not support. There are no Al-Qaeda-backed militants. Al-Qaeda doesn't provide backing. Al-Qaeda is irrelevant. They are Islamist. That means they're Muslims. The correct terminology would have been Salaf. Salaf applies to Sunni Muslims who are fundamentalists. Those would be Sunni Muslims who adhere to the example and words of the first Muslims. They would live in harmony with the Islamic Quran and Hadith. They would do as Muhammad and his first Muslims did, which means that they will be terrorists. They will be rapists. They will be kidnappers. They will be mass murderers. They will torture. They will be thieves. They will kidnap for ransom, because that's what Muhammad and the first Muslims did. This story came out at the end of last week, but it is still appropriate. Reuters reports, Syria's first peace talks came close to collapsing before they began on Friday. So the peace talks on Friday nearly collapsed before they began, with the opposition refusing to meet President Bashar al-Assad's delegation and the government threatening to bring its team home. The opposition said on Friday that it, by the way, and the opposition is not represented. Those who are actually engaged in the battle to depose Assad are not there. So it is a puppet opposition. But the puppet opposition said early on Friday that it would not meet Assad's delegation unless it first agreed to sign up to a protocol calling for a transitional government. Sounds like the way that the mythical people known as the Palestinians approach any peace talks. They say, you will have to capitulate on all of our terms and everything we want, or we won't even show up. And once you have capitulated, we'll show up. But, of course, we won't honor any of our agreements. We won't make any concession that we're willing to live with. The government rejected the demand outright and said its negotiators would return home unless serious talks began within a day. If no serious work sessions are held by Saturday, the official Syrian delegation will leave Geneva due to the other side's lack of seriousness or preparedness, the Syrian state television quoted Foreign Minister Walid al-Muselem. Quote, we have explicitly demanded a written commitment from the regime delegation to accept Geneva I. Otherwise, there will be no direct negotiations, opposition delegate Mele told Reuters. Geneva I, which is an accord that has been drawn up between West Europe, Saudi Arabia, the United States, and exiled Syrian representatives who don't represent either side, says that Assad has to leave. I mean, it's nothing but, I can't even call it wishful thinking, because Assad stepping down will be like Saddam Hussein stepping down. The replacement will be worse than the man who steps down. And so, there is no binding nature to that. Why would Assad accept such a thing? If Assad were to step down, he would be incarcerated, he would be tried, he would be killed. We have created a situation, the West has, based on his prior behavior, that puts Assad in a position where he has no other option but to continue fighting. And by the way, he's winning the war. We'll return to Shattering This after the commercial break. The opposition in Syria isn't in Geneva. The opposition in Syria is on the ground in Syria. It's probably equal parts foreign nationals and the largest recruitment zone is the new Libya. From the very Mujahideen, America empowered by bombing Muammar Gaddafi. It is also they're armed against, as they were to fight Muammar Gaddafi and to have a terrorist government take control of Libya by Qatar, the same country that has supplied the majority of the weapons in the Syrian civil war. And they are on the ground. And they have no interest whatsoever in peace talks, because what they want to impose would never be considered acceptable by the West. So they're not in Geneva. And those that are in Geneva don't represent the opposition. So you've got one of the two parties is again mythological. And they say that they're there to discuss a transition that will remove from power. They're actually there because they want the West to impose them on the Syrian people. That's what they want. They want this perception that they can go in and be the transitional government. They want to be empowered. It's like Sisi saying that he wants to run for president. It's the military leader in Egypt, the top general. The government says that it's there to talk about fighting terrorism, the word it uses for its enemies, and that no one can force Assad to go. And by the normal definition of the word terrorist, Assad would be right, that most of his attacks are, most of the opposition's attacks are not on the Syrian military, but on Syrian communities. It's interesting, by the way, just as we're talking about terrorism, I watched a documentary yesterday about the fall of the Third Reich. And America, its first action in the war in Europe was to supplement the British bombing of German cities. There was no attempt initially to bomb military targets, although we did a fair amount of that later in the war. The first attempt was to make fighting the war difficult for the German people. And so we dropped leaflets over German cities and said, we're coming. And we're going to impose a horrible condition upon you. And we're going to continue to come so that it becomes impossible for the German people to support the war effort. When you use that tactic against civilian towns, and we turned Germany into rubble, cities into rubble, when you use that tactic, you are a terrorist. Those are terrorist tactics. And so you have to be really careful with the word terrorist. I'm declaring a war against that kind of tactic because most every country in the world uses that tactic. America used the tactic both in Europe against Germany and again against Japan. The UN spokesperson said that there are no Syrian talks at the moment. I cannot tell you anything about what will happen in the next few days. Even before the announcement that direct talks were canceled for Friday, the outlook was dim. Syria's civil war has already killed at least 130,000 people, driven up to a third of the country's 22 million people from their homes, and has made the country wholly dependent on external aid. Among the hurdles to progress, Islamic militants who control most rebel-held territory are boycotting the talks and say anyone attending negotiations that fail to bring Assad down would be traitors. Well, it's more than just that. They're boycotting the talks because of their agenda. They've stated their agenda, and they know their agenda isn't going to be accepted by the United Nations. So they're just not there. Assad's main regional backer, Iran, is also not represented at the Geneva talks. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon invited Tehran at the last minute, but then withdrew the invitations 24 hours later because of pressure from the United States. During Wednesday's opening ceremony, the government delegation drew a rebuke from Ban for using inflammatory language after referring to a speech from rebels raping dead women, ripping fetuses from the womb, and eating human organs. They told the truth. You see, in the United Nations, truth is not popular. There has to be a recognition here that there are no good sides, and that the only intelligent thing to do is to start arming either side. Our next story just demonstrates the futility of trying to establish a country that you have broken, particularly in the Islamic world. This appeared about a week ago. The story reads as follows. A school being built in Afghanistan with foreign contractors and funds from American taxpayers has become a money pit. It's kind of like the headquarters for the United States in Afghanistan. I think in the headquarters we spent something like $60 million and haven't occupied it and will never occupy it and are thinking about tearing it down because the way that it's built would be counterproductive for the Afghanis to move into it. Well, this school, from funds from the U.S. Taxpayers, is a money pit. It's not even safe for anyone to go inside. After 5 years of construction, now, mind you, this building, you know, it's like 150 feet by 50 feet. I mean, it's just a two- or three-story, I think it's two-story, cinder block building. I mean, there is, architecturally, there is literally nothing to this. Well, after 5 years of construction, a building like that, you should be able to build in 6 to 9 months. The school still is not completed and will require multiple repairs before it can be transferred to Afghan authorities, they report. From the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction's office said, reconstruction office is interesting. Yeah, we went in just like Iraq and Afghanistan and we broke the country. You know, we bombed it. We broke it. And now we're trying to reconstruct what we destroyed. That's a wonderful use of one's military, don't you think? Use your military, which you pay a fortune for, to deploy extraordinarily expensive weapons to break country. And then after you've broken the country, spend ever more money trying to reconstruct it and making your reconstructions nothing more than a money pit. Some of the building's problems include leaks, crossing sewer lines, and incomplete electrical system that has numerous deficiencies. The architecture is so poor that the second floor terrace, so outside of the second floor, there's a terrace. You know, if you're going to build a terrace, no matter what floor of a building it's on, it has to drain away from the building. Well, guess what? It drains towards the building. So when it does rain, all it does is funnel rain into the top floor, which then drips down onto the bottom floor, destroying everything in between. USAID, U.S. Aid, provided about $17.1 million to the Army Corps of Engineers to construct 16 facilities like this across the war-torn country. The facilities followed a standard design that included 10 classrooms, 4 laboratories, and other amenities. The Army Corps of Engineers awarded $2.9 million in a contract to the Iraqi company to build a facility in this area. The Iraqi company was issued 62 deficiency notices involving its poor work. Now, beyond the fact that we've squandered $17 million just in this one project, these schools, they say, were intended to prepare students to become teachers at the secondary level. When we leave Afghanistan, there will be no such schools teaching anything where you would use a laboratory. Science won't be taught. History will not be taught. There will be no teaching in foreign languages. There will be absolutely no classes on anything other than the Quran and Hadith. That'll be it. Those classes will be available only to boys. Girls will not be able to attend. So that's what's going to happen. So, and it's even worse than that. The young boys and girls who are attending these classes to prepare themselves to teach subjects that the Taliban is not going to tolerate, are going to be hunted down, and they will be killed. So what we're doing is assuredly tattooing future victims for the Taliban. Every bit of this will be discarded. They'll raise the buildings. They'll hunt down and kill those who taught there. They'll hunt down and kill those who were taught there. And then they're going to impose Sharia law and teach nothing but Islam, making tomorrow's future monsters. On Thursday, I was in the midst of reporting a number of stories on the Roman Catholic Church. And before I return to those stories, I'd like to share with you why I think the Roman Catholic Church is actually 5 billion trillion times worse than what we experienced at Penn State. Not a little worse than Penn State. Now, Penn State's probably the single greatest scandal in the last few decades in America in terms of everybody universally being disgusted by what occurred. You know, at Penn State, you had a single perpetrator who was no longer affiliated with the university, who molested little children, mostly at his home, mostly out of sight of the university. And there were only a couple of instances where the higher-ups at the university were given some indication that he was acting badly. And they chose not to act on behalf of current and future victims. So let's compare the two stories. First, with Penn State, there was one pedophile. He was no longer an employee. He did not hold any official office with the university when he abused children. With the Roman Catholic Church, there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of pedophile priests who are authorized agents of the church, who are employees of the church, and were so during the times they committed acts of pedophilia. Well, just run the odds on that. You're talking about 5,000 times the number of perpetrators, and it's 10 times worse if the perpetrator is an agent, an authorized agent of the institution as opposed to someone who has long since retired. So 5,000 times 10, 50,000 times worse for the RCC. At Penn State, 10 children were seriously abused. The RCC has abused well over 100,000 children. Now, there's 30,000, just the tiny little sliver of population that represents Northern Ireland. So we're dealing with 10 versus 100,000. That's 10,000 times worse for the Roman Catholic Church. At Penn State, those who should have known and should have acted in defense of children were fired. Penn State conducted an open, independent investigation, hired a firm that was whose skill set was to do such investigations. That investigation was not only conducted, but its findings were published, as were all internal documents, even at the highest level. The RCC allowed the pedophiles to keep their jobs. Those who actually knew and had overwhelming evidence that priests were acting in a manner to abuse children remained in power. And they all have engaged in a deliberate cover-up. And they still have not published the documents at the highest level. If you were to bring these comparisons all and to apply a numerical value to them, the fact that the pedophiles have kept their job has got to be at least 100 times worse. The fact that those who actually knew remained in power is 10 times, 100 times worse, or 1,000 times worse. And the difference is that in the Roman Catholic Church, they had absolute evidence of who was committing acts of pedophilia, where they only had hints in the case of Penn State. And the fact that they have all remained in power, the senior administrators of the Roman Catholic Church, is 100 times worse. So collectively, this is 1,000. And the fact that at Penn State, they didn't do proactively what they should have done, but the Roman Catholic Church, it's not that they didn't do what they should have done. It's that they came up with a deliberate, purposeful cover-up. And they perpetrated a cover-up, which is a criminal act. Collectively, that's about 1,000 times worse. At Penn State, they never tried to intimidate the victims, nor tried to silence them. They did not claim that the eternal fate of a child's soul was in their hands. They voluntarily paid the ten most serious victims millions of dollars on their own initiative. With the Roman Catholic Church, they routinely tried to get the victims to swear an oath of silence. They promised a heavenly reward for those willing to protect the church's reputation. They have had to be prosecuted to compensate their victims. And it's only in losing those trials that they have agreed to compensate anyone. I think each of those issues is 100 times worse than what happened at Penn State. At Penn State, the pedophile, he's in prison. The president of the university is indicted. The head football coach was disgraced. He was fired. The Roman Catholic Church has seen to it that less than 0.1% of the pedophiles were ever imprisoned. And none of the cardinals or popes have stood trial or have been imprisoned because they claimed diplomatic immunity. The latter is about 10,000 times worse, the former about 1,000 times worse. You do the math. and it's 5 billion trillion trillion times worse. It's extraordinarily easy to claim, and the facts will attest to this, that the Roman Catholic Church is the most evil institution on earth. Now, from my perspective, and you don't have to hold this perspective, you can choose to prioritize a different crime. But from my perspective, the single worst crime that a person can perpetrate is an act of pedophilia. When you abuse a child, victimizing a child, you are ruining their lives. And in the case of the Roman Catholic Church, where it's an authorized agent of the church who claims to have God's authority doing such a thing, and then having the church cover it up while victimizing the victim ever more, makes it the worst crime that can be committed. Now that we've put the Roman Catholic tendency to not only engage in pedophilic acts in perspective, to set the stage, I want to share the remaining stories about their, first is about their upcoming meeting, and then the results actually of the meeting they had before the United Nations. I'd also like to throw one other perspective into the ringer here. With the Penn State, there was no luring little boys at their parents' level because they were going to have some, you know, huge benefit of the children being involved with Penn State. And yet, with the Catholic Church, they overtly seek to have parents give them access to their children so that they can bring them up to be Catholics. And so it is my opinion that if you are a Catholic and you send your children to Catholic school or you have your children involved in any way with Catholic masses and give your children access or give the priest access to your child, you don't deserve to be a parent. Now, I don't care that you're stupid enough to be a Roman Catholic. I don't care. Ruin your life. Waste your life. It doesn't matter to me. But when you subject your children to this, in my view, you're not qualified to be a parent. Not based upon what we know now about the Roman Catholic Church. There's something seriously wrong with your ability to be moral and to exercise the duties of a parent. Now, that said, CBS reporting from Vatican City, we covered the first two or three statements in this, but I'll bring them back up so that we're current. The Vatican, this was written 2 weeks ago, was gearing up for a bruising showdown over the global priest sex abuse scandal, forced for the first time to defend itself at length and in public against allegations that it enabled the rape of tens of thousands, and it's actually hundreds of thousands of children, by protecting pedophile priests and its own reputation at the expense of the victims. The Holy See on Thursday will be grilled. This was Thursday a week ago. Was grilled now by a United Nations committee in Geneva. It's interesting that the Syrian civil war meeting and the grilling of the Roman Catholic Church over its propensity to not only commit pedophilic acts but to cover them up were both in Geneva at the same time. They're there because of the implementation and the fact that they're a signatory on the UN Convention for the Rights of the Child. Among other things, the treaty calls for all signatories to take all appropriate measures to protect children from harm and to put children's interests above all else. Well, the Roman Catholic Church has two problems with that. They have subjected children to harm because they have continuously moved pedophilic priests around as opposed to providing evidence to local judicial authorities that they would be imprisoned, and they have always put their own interests above the interests of their constituents. The Holy See ratified the convention in 1990 and submitted a first implementation report in 1994, but it didn't provide progress reports for nearly a decade and only submitted one in 2012 after coming under worldwide criticism following the 2010 explosion of child abuse cases in Europe and beyond. Victims groups and human rights organizations rallied together to press the United Nations Committee to challenge the Roman Catholic Church on its abuse record. Providing written testimony from the victims and evidence outlined the global scale of the problem. Their reports cite case studies in Mexico and Britain, grand jury investigations in the U.S., and government fact-finding inquiries from Canada to Ireland to Australia that detail how the Vatican's policy, its culture of secrecy, and fear of scandal has all exacerbated the problem. Their submissions reference Vatican documents that show that its officials knew about notorious Mexican molester decades before taking action. They cite correspondence from a Vatican cardinal praising a French bishop's decision to protect his abusive priests, and another Vatican directive to Irish bishops to strike any mandatory reporting of abusers to police from their policies. The submissions even quote the former Vatican number two as saying bishops shouldn't be expected to turn priests in. The Vatican's number two was Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope. As the case in Mexico, this was Marcel Marcier, and he was protected because he was the single largest source of Vatican donations and the largest supplier of new priests to the Roman Catholic Church.